Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, October 14th. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again to talk car maintenance and repair with our friend Gordon Fricke. Gordon is the owner and operator of Barber and Fricke, an automotive, I guess you'd call it an independent repair, towing, and used car place in Hoosick Falls, New York. We welcome your car calls at 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. It's usually a popular show when Gordon is here, as he's dispensing free advice. So if you have a question, I would say call now and get in line. 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Gordon Fricke and your car calls coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to the show. It's Vox Pop, you know, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. On the show today, to answer your automotive maintenance and repair questions, is Gordon Fricke, owner and operator of Barber and Fricke Automotive, an independent repair, towing, and used car facility in Hoosick Falls, New York. Gordon has been in the automotive repair and service industry for more than 30 years, and it's always great to have him on the show. If you have a car question, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can email us as well, voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke, welcome back. How are you?
Thanks, Ray. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. You hit a little traffic coming in, but you made it.
I did. You know, I'm always here quite early. Ed was out saying, you know, when do you get here? I said, usually 15 minutes ahead of time just to be safe.
Yeah.
Well, today I ran into a pickle on 787. And it was endless.
Ah.
So I snuck off the Menands exit and wiggled my way back onto Route 9.
Okay. And you, we were just talking about
yeah.
this, how today you really can't do it without these apps that give you directions. Remember the old days?
Maps.
I say that a lot on this show. But remember when we had the wherewithal in our brains to sort of figure it out?
And pull over and ask somebody.
And it's not an embarrassment to do that.
No, it's actually kind of fun sometimes.
Yeah. Well, you made it all the same, and that's good. The number here is 800-348-2551. Last time you were on, we did a little segment, informal segment called What Would Roger Do or Roger Say?
What Would Roger Think?
Yes. And so you said you have another situation that might apply here.
Well, we could put a whole show together on these situations.
I'm sure we could, man.
Just what came to mind this morning, I was talking to Don, who worked with Roger, as I explained when we introduced this whole little
Ron works at Barber and Fricke with
Don.
You.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, Don,
yeah.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, and he worked with Roger.
Right.
So last week, I had a Mercedes-Benz. I had a customer call or a person call, say, I got this really weird thing happening with my car. It's a C300 4MATIC, and the marker light or the running lights on the passenger side of the car, so the right front and the right rear, light up by themselves. No key, no car running, locked, the whole deal. And those two lights will light up, and they'll stay on maybe for an hour or two, then they'll go off. Might stay on all night. The battery's dead. Next day, fine. 2 days later, lights back on.
Huh.
Pattern's getting worse. Now it's happening every single day. So I'm thinking, do I really want to get involved with anything like this? But I said, you know, I have rebooted a lot of cars, just like your phone
yeah.
and your desktop.
Yeah.
We're doing this with cars.
Yeah.
So I said, look, if it's deep software, it's got to go to the Mercedes-Benz dealer, but I will certainly do what I can do. So I got the car in, and the battery was weak. I recharged it, and I rebooted the car. And I've explained this reboot to people on the show here, and you've always cringed because what I'm telling them to do is to just I don't have any hearing.
You can't hear it?
Yeah.
All right. Turn the volume up a little bit. Maybe you got the wrong headphones on?
No.
No?
Well, yeah. Here we go. We're back.
Okay.
I don't know if one of the engineers heard me.
No, I don't think so. I don't think Riley did anything over there,
yeah.
But that's okay.
Charge the battery, disconnect the battery from the car.
Yep.
And I mean, you really need to just take the negative terminal completely off of the battery. And I even go so far as covering up the post with a rag or something so it can't touch.
Okay.
And then I join the two together away from the battery.
Yeah.
This is the part you don't like.
No, I don't like this.
And then you join them together with either a jumper wire, or you can hold them together, but you need to be on there for, I like to do it for 5 or 10 minutes. You can do it as long as you want and do it overnight. So I left the car alone for an hour or so, connected it back up. Lights not in, the two phantom lights are not
right
coming on.
Right.
I bring everything back up, get all the settings and everything's going. Park the car outside, I leave it there for a day and a half, 2 days. The light has never come back on. So I think that was a successful reboot. But that was something that you wouldn't even imagine doing probably 20 or 10 years ago we were rebooting cars, but 20 years ago, 30 years ago, unheard of.
Right. Well, there weren't that many computers. I mean, there were some.
And then we had one more today, and it was doing rear brake pads and rotors on a late model Nissan Rogue.
Mm-hmm.
And the parking brake or the emergency brake is electronically operated. There's no lever that you pull or pedal you push, it's electric.
Yeah.
You got to.
I don't like that.
No, and they come on automatically. If you come to a stop, put the car in park, a lot of these cars put the parking brake on instantly.
Oh, I do not like that.
No. So to do the brakes, you have to get into the computer with your scan tool and command the parking brake to open the calipers for you.
Yeah.
On this particular car, we have to get permission through an outside agency to access the vehicle's computer via Wi-Fi in the shop.
Who's the outside agency?
It's a company that partners with the scan tool company and the car makers, and you have to pay a subscription.
Yeah.
And when you want to get into those systems, it makes sure that you're valid, you've paid the subscription, and then it says the vehicle is now unlocked and you can perform your maintenance or repair work.
That is, okay. That annoys me a great
deal. I knew
it
would. That's why I brought that up.
Well, thank you. What, do you want to annoy me? Congratulations. You know, when you were talking about the way that you reset car computers, the reason it freaks me out so much, when I was thinking about this the other day. When I was a kid, maybe 10, somebody on a couple streets over, teenager, was working on a battery.
Oh, boy.
And all of a sudden, boom.
Yes.
Like the loud, deep explosion. And I think the kid was very badly hurt.
Well, that's what we were talking about today in the shop. And I told Don, I said, Ray really hates it when I recommend this. And I'm so careful to say that battery is totally disconnected from the car. Cover up the terminal. You're going nowhere near the battery
right now.
But I could see that somebody getting it mixed up, crossing up the terminals.
Yeah.
The battery blows up.
Yep.
And
Badly burned, I think the guy was.
Some expert recommended I do this.
Yeah,
look what happened.
Right. So, you know, don't try this at home.
Right.
Gordon Fricke's a professional. What does Don say? Does he do this sometimes?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Everybody who's in your business does this from time to time?
To reboot cars?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, it just was successful on Don's uncle in Georgia. Had a weird situation with an interior light, and they rebooted that car and it solved it.
You know, if you didn't have a computer controlling those lights, if it was hardwired and you manually threw the switch and there was a relay, then you just replace the relay or whatever and it's fine, right?
They were simpler times, yes.
Mm. Okay, well, let's grab an email or two before the first break and then we'll go to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number if you want to jump in and ask a question of Gordon Fricke. Tom in Little Falls writes, you've spoken on several occasions of how modern engines burn oil rapidly. I use 5W-20 in my 2018 Hyundai, which switching to a heavier weight oil reduce consumption?
Good question. Answer, yes, to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to change the viscosity too much as per the manufacturer's recommendations, because they've got a lot of stuff in those engines that are designed to work with a certain weight oil.
Yeah.
Mainly the camshaft controls, the valve controls, the variable valve timing and all those things. But these cars also have a variable electronically controlled oil pumps that change the oil pressure on the fly. But in basic physics, yes, the thicker the oil, the harder it is to escape. And that's either escape out through a seal or a case or a gasket and or past the piston ring. So to a point, yes.
But as the weather gets colder, right, you you want to not be thicker.
Yes, because the thicker it is, the harder it cranks. And when it gets super, super cold, you know, fast forward to Alaska or the Antarctic, the engines would not even turn because it would be like having solid grease in the oil pan.
You know, I'm such a freak about my oil pressure gauge on my dashboard. And how long does it take? I wait until it gets about to the middle point before I pull out.
You're talking about engine temp or oil pressure?
Oil pressure.
Okay.
And 50, I think, is when I say, okay, we're good. The oil's through. How long does it take generally on most cars as an average to get the oil through the system and be safe to drive?
Not long.
No?
No. It's 30 seconds.
Really?
Not even that. That pump's turning as soon as the engine's spinning, the pump is going, and the gauge is a little bit of something that plays tricks with certain operators.
Yes.
John Cahill, who I worked for when I was in my late teens, early 20s,
said
the worst thing they ever put in a car was an oil pressure gauge.
That's so funny.
Because everybody stares at it, and it goes up with the engine speed, it goes down with the lower speed. When it's really hot, it's lower. When it's really cold, it's higher. He said, everybody's freaked out with that gauge. If you just forget the gauge and have a light, and if the light comes on, you better turn the engine off within seconds or it blows up. And that's it.
Okay, fair enough. All right, one more email, then we'll take a break, and then we'll go to the phones. 800-348-2551. It's Cars Today with Gordon Fricke. Timothy wrote in, now that we're approaching the winter season, please set the record straight. When it comes to tire rotation, should it be front to back or should we go from back to front? My dad said one thing, but my young mechanic says something else. Where should the newest tires go?
Well, that has been a subject that has changed.
Because they're so expensive.
Well, that true too, but again, going back to what would Roger think, right? Back in the early days, a quote, conventional car in
rear-wheel
the U.S.
Drive.
Yes, rear-wheel drive engine in the front. And as Pat Bukaitis would say, the engine in the right way, like your Le Mans. The engine was facing north-south.
Isn't that the way they all are?
No, they're transverse now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like even the engine in your Cadillac, I believe, is transverse.
Maybe.
But some are in line or longitudinal, some are transverse.
Okay.
But back to the original question, all the weight's on the front now. The front tires are steering, driving, and doing most of the braking. The back end's much lighter and floating around back there. So ideally, you'd want the most traction up front.
Right.
So a few years ago, I say a few years, 10, 15 years ago, it was discovered if there's too much traction in the front, the back end is too loose, and the back end will swing around on you, and you'll lose control of the car.
Yeah.
So now they're saying if you've got slightly better tires, put them to the rear so the back end stays more planted in slippery weather.
That makes sense.
So the back end isn't fishtailing due to lack of weight and traction.
Sure. Yeah.
That doesn't mean put bald tires on the front and new ones on the rear, but
right. It
has changed a bit as to where you think the best, deepest tread should go.
Very interesting.
Did I answer anything just now?
I think you did. And we're way over time on the break, so you really did your job. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's Gordon Fricke. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. Gordon Fricke's our guest today. It's Cars at 800-348-2551. Let's go right to the phones. Your headphones working now?
I'm hearing everything now.
Okay, let's turn. Yeah, now we'll hear you. Okay, we good to go? Let's go to Westfield, Massachusetts. Chris, you're on.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Oh, pretty
good.
Appreciate
you taking the call.
You bet.
My question... they asked me, I just bought an older truck, 2013 Tundra, but overall question. You know, it's using the manual shifting part, you know, it's an automatic, no clutch. But, you know, if we're going down big hills or if you want to get on it, does it hurt the engine or transmission using that?
No.
In any car?
No, it has parameters, so you can't really overdo it as far as overspeeding
right.
the engine, or it'll eventually not allow you to do things outside of what's safe. But no, you can use that. And on your Tundra, how do you operate it? Is that a like a plus or minus on your shifter lever, or where is it controlled on that truck?
It's got, you know, it's like an old stick shift. It's kind of cool.
And oh, right, right.
The,
yes.
When it's in the drive, you can just kind of knock it to the left.
Yes.
And it puts it in that manual.
Yeah.
But it works great. I mean, it goes to like a sports truck.
Yes. Yep. Yep. Porsche.
And that's like same.
Yeah, I was just going to say Porsche actually developed that type of an automatic transmission. They called it a Tiptronic. Came about in the 80s, I believe. And it was a way to get people to maybe think they're kind of shifting an automatic so you're not stuck in just a drive mode or low. So no, to answer your question, you certainly can use that as you like.
Okay, cool.
All right. Chris.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, I think my caddy has that. I used it about three different times.
And most people don't ever use it.
It's kind of a gimmick.
I've got one car with, or I had a car with paddle shifters.
Oh, yeah, that's cool.
Okay, great. You use it for an hour, and then you're sick of it. It's not like having a clutch and a shift lever.
I love a standard transmission.
Exactly.
You know, but this is not the same.
No.
Without the clutch, it just doesn't feel right.
No, and it's still going through an automatic, so you're not getting that direct, harsh connection between basically the crankshaft and the wheels.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. Number here is 800-348-2551. It's Gordon Fricke Day on Vox Pop. Let's go to Holyoke. Sarah, you're on.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I just had a question about, just a clarifying question about what you were talking about earlier with rebooting the car.
Oh, no.
Am I to understand that you disconnect the battery completely and then you take the two, I guess, cables that would usually connect to the battery and connect those two together
with each other? Ray just gave me a look.
Yeah, now you've done it again.
Yeah, we've opened up the reboot can of worms. Yes.
I'm not planning to do this at home because, like Ray, the battery stuff gives me the heebie-jeebies. I don't like going anywhere near it at all.
Yes, yeah.
No. Which is why when I heard you saying this, my head spun and
But remember, there's no juice because it's not connected to the battery.
Yes.
That's
so,
the key to this whole, you know, not dying while you do this.
This maneuver is as if the battery wasn't even in the car.
Right.
You are disconnecting the...
Right, so you're like closing the loop without the power source.
Exactly, yes. Yeah, perfect. And the way I do it, and I explained earlier, is I usually take off the negative terminal, unless it's impossible to get to, mm-hmm. and I then cover that mm-hmm. post up with a rag or a glove or something, so I just can't make any mistake.
Mess up.
And then, correct, and then you are looping the positive and negative cables together. And what that does is it drains all of the capacitors and all of the modules to basically square one. So any corruption that's in there electronically or electrons dissipate.
So you have to leave the positive terminal on.
You don't have to.
You can take that off too. Then you can feel much safer,
you
right?
You can take them both off of the battery, which is it makes you feel better, yes. Then the battery is not connected in any way, shape, or form to the electrical system.
And then you'll live, Sarah. Then you'll live.
So, yeah, I mean, the safest thing, take them both off, cover up the posts, and then join the two together, and make sure you're joining them accurately because the amount of voltage that you are draining off is absolutely minute.
Okay.
So any chance of a bad connection due to corrosion or grease or anything is high. So you have to make sure you've got a perfect connection on those two terminals.
Mm.
And that just drains everything down. The computers, I mean, the programming is all there and all of the microchips aren't being damaged.
So they're EEPROM or something
all of
like
that's,
that.
All of that programming is unaffected.
Okay.
You're just draining the corruption out of it.
Okay. Sarah, what do you think?
I see. I understand. That answers my question. I was also fascinated because I do electrical work in like HVAC controls and building automation. So we do work with a lot of low voltage and signal cables and things like that. So I was just curious about the mechanism, but the idea of closing the loop to drain out all of the excess junk makes a lot of sense to me.
Yes. I started doing this at least probably more than 10 years ago, because Volkswagen had a problem with their alarm system. The factory alarm would call it logic locked, and it would, you couldn't start the car. It was if it was in theft mode.
Oh.
You couldn't scan it. You couldn't clear anything. And I have this really great guy on a tech line that's in Minnesota, and I go to him for VW and Audi advice, and he said, let's try this. And he told me how to do this, and bang, the car started.
I'll be darned.
And I did it, you know, I don't know about hundreds, but lots and lots of times after that.
All right, Sarah, well, be careful, and thank you very much. 800-348-2551, that's the number. Gordon Fricke's our guest, and let's go to Scotia. Mike, you're on. Mike.
Hi, Gordon. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because my grandson is now just a new driver, and he's using the family car that's 10 years old, 2015 Cadillac SRX, and he can't drive at night yet, but I've turned the headlights on that car at night, and it might as well have a 9-volt battery or a 9-volt flashlight pointing out the front of the car. It's horrendous how dim it is. And I'm wondering if you've run into this before.
Yes. Same car, roughly the same year. I have customers that own one, and they're so frustrated with the lighting. So apparently your car is probably standard halogen bulbs. I can't believe it's an HID car, or you wouldn't be complaining, or your grandchildren, whoever, would not be complaining about the lighting capability. Does that car have running lights in the front bumper cover, you know, fog light running lights?
I don't know.
Okay.
But if I can just clarify about the bulbs, my my son-in-law went out and had the bulbs replaced on the car, and it what the shop put in was not LED. They told him that there had been LEDs in it, and they replaced them with HIDs.
Oh.
So if that car has HID lighting, that is a high-end lighting system with ballast what are the boosters in ballasts that will boost the voltage.
Right.
So if you've already got HIDs, which are also called xenon lights, you've got pretty much as good as you can get.
Maybe it's not equipped for those HID lights, and there's no ballast, and it's the voltage is too low.
I guess it depends on what the lighting system of the car came with, because that's old enough to where it could be standard bulbs. But if they've been changed, here's the more of the story. If it's a car with standard halogen bulbs, you can swap it to LEDs. They use less energy, and they are way brighter, and they're most of the time they're just drop-ins.
Okay.
The early ones had fans on them, but there's companies that make them now. They just simply plug and play, and I've got them in a couple of vehicles, and they did the trick.
Ah.
Also, the clarity of the lenses is very important. If those headlight lenses are yellowing or getting dull, they're going to block so much light that unless you, if you can get them polished and clean, that's fine. The only other option is replacing the lamp, and that's quite expensive.
Mm. Mike.
Right. At one point, he complained, didn't complain, but went back to the dealer that he bought the car from and talked to them about solving the problem. And what they told him was essentially they can solve it, but it would be replacing the entire light, not the bulb, but the light,
the lamp.
Yes.
Housing on both sides. And to do that, they need to take the front end apart, take the grill off, and a bunch of other stuff.
Probably the bumper cover.
Right. And so.
Very expensive.
A shocking price to me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
$3,000.
Yikes. Zoinks. You know what? Go with the LEDs. Put the LEDs back in.
If you can. If it's an HID car, you're stuck with HID bulbs because they're totally, they're unique.
Right.
Nothing interchanges with them. If it is halogen, you can drop LEDs in their place.
He said it had LEDs originally, right?
I don't think they had LED in 15.
Okay. All right. Well, Mike, good luck. Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. It's Gordon Fricke Day. Let's go to North Adams. Diane's turn. Hello, Diane.
Hi.
Hello.
I have a totally different call.
Okay.
My Honda CRV is a 2013, and it's got 103,000 miles on it. I've had it for 7 years. It's in excellent condition. It probably needs a new muffler. And friends of mine are insisting that because of my age, I'm almost 80, I should get rid of this car and buy a new one. So I own this car outright. I like not having monthly car payments. It's serving me well.
Yeah.
It costs me about $1,000 a year, maybe, in repairs. And so I'm inclined to keep it. What do you think?
Well, the fact that it is a CRV and of that vintage, it is an extremely good and reliable car. I mean, I see these cars in with 200,000 miles on them.
Yeah.
Look like they've gone out and plowed fields with them. And I say this all the time. I don't know how these cars can be so durable and hold up so well with such little maintenance and repair sometimes.
Yeah.
So, in my opinion, that's a car that you don't have to run away from. If you've got to put an exhaust on it, that's not the end of the world by any means. Rust is the only concern. And if you go to a normal repair shop with that car, and if they have not said, hey, things are looking pretty rusty under here where your suspension is connected, mm-hmm. your subframes, your rocker panels, then I don't really see you need to run away from that car.
Okay. Diane?
Yay! I'm so happy to hear that because I love my little car.
Yeah, you wanted to keep
it. Well, not so little. I live in North Adams where everything is on a hill one way or the other. And so this car takes me around the snow and rain and ice. And
Here's what I would recommend you do to totally ice the cake. Do you have a repair shop that you go to? Where do you service the car?
Oh, you don't have to say the name of the
place. No. But it's if it's an independent repair shop.
I have a regular repair shop.
Okay.
Yep.
This is what I would do. Ask them the same question you asked me. And if you're due for an oil change or anything upcoming, that would be the time to bring this up.
Yeah.
But ask them to get it on a lift and give it a nice shakedown and look at it in terms of rust and corrosion and get their opinions. Anything looking bad under here that you need to be worried about. If you trust these guys, they're going to tell you the right thing.
Okay.
Cool.
Well, thanks,
Dan. I'll do it. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke is here from Barber and Fricke Automotive in Hoosick Falls. By the way, how's the new place working out?
It's working out great, Ray, but I term it as the lifeboat from the Titanic.
Why?
Well, it's so small. You remember my old building?
Yeah.
I mean, that was like 11,000 square feet.
But there's plenty of room in there you and Don.
It's fine. No, it is fine. It's very good. Yeah.
All right. Let's go to John in Catskill, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll come back and check the email back. John, you're on.
Hi. I'm calling about my 2017 Volvo V60 T6. And what I'm wondering is it has low-profile tires. And in New York, I mean, I've bent two rims separately. And I was wondering, can I switch it from low profile by getting smaller wheels and bigger tires?
Yes. Yep, you can. And there's a really... go ahead.
No, go ahead. I think you're going to tell me what I want to know.
Yes. Well, there's a couple of very good online tire companies that will allow you to enter the vehicle, your make, model, and equipment, and then it will identify. It'll ask you, is this your wheel size, and that'll give you options of plussing up or plussing down, which means in your case you're going to want to go to a smaller diameter wheel with a higher profile tire to get more rubber between the wheel and the tire, and it's a good idea because the lower the profile, the harsher the ride. the more damage you're going to experience, the more tires are going to split and crack from hitting potholes and cracks and debris in the road. And the traction is worse because they're so wide and stiff.
Mm.
So in your case, what you've described to me, that's a good idea.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much, guys.
John, thanks for the call. We'll take a break here. 800-348-2551 is the number. Gordon Fricke's the guest. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Check the email bag coming up. Oh, yeah, he could pick it. There's J.C. Styles, I Can't Help It, on Vox Pop. Ray Graff with you. It's Gordon Fricke Day today. It's cars, 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Matt writes in, I recently bought a new Hyundai Elantra. I haven't been able to get the maintenance schedule. It's not in the owner's manual. I also asked the dealership, are manufacturers required to provide a maintenance schedule for oil changes, et cetera?
You know, I don't know if they're required, but it's in their best interest for the life of the vehicle and the owner and the dealership to perform the maintenance. And obviously it's at a profit.
Yeah.
Unless it's anything that's under some plan or program. So I can't believe that maintenance schedule is not available somewhere.
It's usually
in
the back of the manual, right?
Sometimes they have a separate booklet that's maintenance only.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of cars, the owner's manuals are now online. So I would imagine you could go on Hyundai's website or somebody's and get that maintenance schedule.
Why would they be only online? What if you are in Iowa and there is no cell phone coverage and your car breaks down and you say, well, what's going on here?
I have noticed that in some new cars where there's nothing but a thin quick guide to the car. Quick guide. First and foremost, sound system. How do you get the radio to work? Heat, controls, directionals, lighting, and all that stuff. But it's not 100 pages thick. It says go online for the complete
manual.
That's
not acceptable in any way.
And
I agree
with you.
I'm irritated now.
Yeah.
This is from Kayla, who says, I'm looking for a used car. Do you have a suggestion for the best used vehicles when it comes to value and longevity? I ask you to give a couple brands if you're going to do this. You know?
Well, it's no secret, depending on the need or the type of vehicle that this person is interested in, you know, truck, car, van, bus, whatever. But Honda, Toyota have established fantastic reputations. Subaru's up there. A manufacturer that gets overlooked all the time and they make really great vehicles, Mazda.
Yep.
Yep.
Okay.
So I've named off
No American cars there on
that
list.
Well, there was a time when the U.S. makers took a terrible dive and quality was horrendous and the Japanese were killing them.
Yeah.
And those brands have improved. And I guess if you go to Consumer Reports or one of those outfits,
that's a good idea.
You would then get maybe a better sampling than the few cars that I've rattled off, because they're going to tell you this car's better for this, this car's better for that. But, you know, I think in this emailer's case, you don't want to probably go out and get a Jag or a Land Rover or something like that.
No. I doubt you would, right? John writes in, my 2016 Ford Focus engine oil warning light just came on after 4,000 miles since the last oil change. Mm. The car has 110,000 miles, runs fine. I haven't driven it much in the last year after putting new full synthetic oil in a year ago and checked the level and color right after the warning occurred. Oil viscosity, color seem almost new. The level is correct. So why am I getting the warning sign? My guess is that it has something to do with some artificial 12-month trigger. Any thoughts?
It didn't say what color the light was.
Negative. No.
So red is trouble. Red means pressure.
Yeah.
Yellow is caution, as in low level or something needs to be looked at, but it's not specifically urgent.
Yeah.
It could be a false warning. It could be, if it's red, that needs to be tended to, and the pressure needs to be confirmed.
Don't drive it then at that point, right?
Well, I would say not, because if it is a pressure situation and it could be remedied, driving it could wipe the engine out.
Yeah.
Or it's a bad sensor and it's indicating there's a pressure problem when there really isn't.
You want to know something about sensors that annoy the daylights out of me? My wife's Traverse, I think it's 2018. It has those wheel sensors, right?
Yep.
Probably the Caddy has it too. I don't know. But so now, I don't know what happened.
You're talking tire pressure sensors?
Yeah, three of them don't work. And I have a yellow light on the dash, and it annoys the daylights out of me. The tires clearly have plenty of air.
Yep.
Why?
2009, it was mandatory for all manufacturers to provide some type of low tire warning. And it was recommended by the, is it NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic?
I don't know.
Because, and when we do state inspections, we're required to check the tire pressures. And it's purely for reporting and statistics because there are so many cars out there with low tire pressure. So they said if you get a warning in the car, people will be keeping track of their tires and there'll be less accidents and problems.
You know, if we went back to full-service gas stations, everyone would have properly inflated tires. Who wants to stop in and either pay for gas or, B, find the free place and pull it up and do it yourself?
Interesting you say that because when Roger did a service, he checked the tire pressures. And Don and I always do when we do a service. But I get cars coming in from the, I'm not going to drop in names, but the, quote, quick lubes.
Yeah.
They don't check much of anything. And I've had people come in a week later saying, my low coolant light's on. And I was just at XYZ lube.
Yeah.
And coolant's at the bottom of the add mark. Then I noticed that the tires are all mixed pressures and none of them been checked. You know, it's a matter of diligence and checking stuff.
All right, let's go back to the phones. It's Gordon Fricke, and we'll go to Gilderland. Peter is up. Peter, go ahead.
Hello. Thanks. I heard you talking about batteries. I don't think you answered this question. I might have missed anything. So we had a 2018 Nissan Rogue. We broke down the other day, and it turned out to be was it needed a battery. But other things before this happened seemed to be going weak, like seat adjustment wasn't working. And my wife noticed maybe some other things electronically. So my question is, does a bad battery tend to draw things from electronics and possibly make things not work as well as they should?
Yes, but the reason...
yes.
The answer is yes. And sometimes prior to the battery failing to the point where it has to be replaced under maybe almost an emergency, there will be a lot of low voltage issues in the vehicle. A lot of code stored and a lot of modules freak out and they won't work right because they're getting the wrong voltage. So yes, electronics will start failing or acting weird. Lights like that, Mercedes can come on.
Okay.
So the idea there, and that battery was way overdue. If it was a 2018 car, man, that battery lasted a long time. Although we do get some European cars that batteries are lasting 10 years, sometimes more. But it's a good idea. If a battery up in the Northeast is 5 years old, it really should be checked. It should be tested because it's probably going to be on the way out, especially this time of the year, heading into cold weather.
All right, Peter.
Yeah, sure. Right. Yeah. Well, you just think that it won't start the car, but I never realized.
Yeah. Way more to it.
Was everything. And I'll say one other thing. You mentioned Iowa.
Yeah.
I was just out there. Do you folks know why it's so humid out there sometimes?
Why?
Corn sweat.
Huh. Corn sweat. Well, Peter.
Is that like sweet corn?
That's the term.
That's interesting, man.
That's the term.
I'll be darned. Well, I learned something new, and I didn't expect to. And thank you, Peter. I appreciate the call. Let's go to South Hadley. It's Joanna. Hello, Joanna.
Hello. I have a 2009 Toyota Prius, and the front lenses on it are pretty kind of cloudy looking. It always just passed inspection. But I've done a little reading online. There seem to be some kits that you get that have several different levels of grit sandpaper, and you have to clean with special towels, and then you do the sandpaper, and then you apply the final whatever.
Yep.
You had mentioned a couple callers ago about having like a dealer polish and whatever the lenses. What are your thoughts about the best way to do this?
Yep, same process. They're just allowing do-it-yourselfers to do it with all the stuff in a kit.
Yeah.
The way the body shops do it, the professionals, they do the same thing. They will Start with a heavier grip paper, and not for headlights. You're not starting out like an 80 grit, but you're going to end up probably finishing off with 1,000 or 1,500 grit, which is polish basically. Uh-huh. And then on top of that, you then buff and polish those lenses with a machine buffer. And if the lens is good and the fogging is not on the inside, they can come out almost like new.
Oh, okay.
The home kits are great because they give you all the stuff to do. Follow the instructions. Be diligent. And I think at the end they give you something to smear on them or spray on them to give them a nice clear. But long story short, they're very effective, and they will get your lighting improved.
Yeah, the do-it-yourself kit that I was reading about online had a final polishing grid of 2,000.
Yeah, okay, yep, 2,000 is the end. Yep, that's pretty fine.
Yep.
All right.
Okay, so either way is the way to go. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for the call. Now, what about the super lazy way? You know, again, I think I've mentioned this. I was in the parking lot of a car place, auto parts store, and a couple guys lived nearby. Obviously, they had a little scam going, and they said, "Ah, we'll do this for you for $10." So I didn't want to get knifed, so I had it done, and it worked for a while.
Is that the stuff they just smeared on?
Yeah.
Them? No buffing or polishing,
no.
just a liquid.
So they sell that kind of thing in the store. How long would you figure that would last? Because, I mean, I wouldn't mind buying one every 2 months if it works.
Yeah, it does improve. It doesn't take the yellowing away because you haven't really removed anything.
Yeah.
But it will take the fogginess away. And if the lens isn't too bad, it really does a decent job. And
okay.
You're right, it's inexpensive, and you can do it yourself.
All right.
It lasts as long as it does if you're going through car washes or rainstorms, and then you reapply it.
Okay. Let's go to Scott in Slingerland. Scott, you're on with Gordon Fricke.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
I have a 2011 Honda Pilot with over 220,000 miles still going strong. I'm the original owner trying to get it to my third and youngest child to drive to high school. Was recently, back in early August, I drove it up to beautiful Thatcher Park. As I was winding up the hill, I was behind a wide load, and it was going like 5 miles an hour, and the check emissions light came on. Brought it over to the dealer. They said it's a rear bank catalytic converter, bank one.
Ouch.
And possibly the oxygen sensor. They cleared the code. Hasn't come back on since August. I had it successfully inspected. Just curious what you think. I know the new catalytic converters are awfully pricey for an old vehicle.
Right. Yeah. So there are more than just one reason why it'll give you a catalytic converter efficiency code. Sometimes the converter can't clean the air anymore. Other times it's an air leak in the exhaust near the sensor, fooling it.
Right.
Due to a gasket rust, the flex pipe is got a tiny hole in it. You can't hear yet. Rushing to a converter is the last thing you want to do.
Right.
Tight exhaust is very important. Old tired sensors can cause that. So definitely if anybody was to replace that converter, they would do the sensor or sensors if there's two in it. What you can do, if the exhaust sounds perfectly quiet and there's no leaks, you could definitely put some additive in the tank. And there's a handful of them out there that clean catalytic converters. Use a good name brand. And that will just, if it's a deposit issue, this will just help keep them clean.
That's interesting. So, Scott, let me just follow up for a moment. We talk about additives that you pour in the gas tank before you drive, and
yep.
A lot of them will do your fuel injectors and things like that.
Yep.
How is it that they don't also work on the deposits in the catalytic?
They do.
They do?
They do, yes. Yep, they do. What they're there to do is to break down the carbon and other deposits, soot, among other things, to get it removed, get it released, and burn it off or get it out the tailpipe
yeah.
so it's off of the honeycomb of your catalytic
So it's
converter.
Worth a try anyway. And besides,
100%.
It passed inspection, Scott. I think you got a little time, right?
I got another year.
Yeah,
man. Good for you. Well, thank you for the call. Let's go to Jim in Valencia. Jim, you're on. Interesting.
Hello.
Hi, you're on. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you. I've got a 2009 Chevy Silverado, 5.3 liter, and it has an active fuel management system in it. And I heard a lot of horror stories about them. But there's something you can plug into your OBD2 connection to disable that. I just wonder what your thoughts are on that.
So do you have the cylinder deactivation? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, it goes from four to eight. It's normally an eight cylinder, yes. But it drops down to four.
Yep, yep. That was a bit of a problem on those V8 General Motors engines. That valve train did have its problems, and the repair could be extremely expensive to replace that bank of lifters and all that stuff under there. I do believe that there are kits available to disable that. And I don't know if it simply plugs into your data link connector or if it's a kit that you buy and it's a programming. But yes, if you investigate that further, there are devices that will keep that running as a V8 only.
Mm-hmm.
Not a bad idea if it stops, you know, you from having future cylinder deactivation issues. So,
okay,
yes.
Great.
Yes. I could answer that earlier by saying yes.
Go ahead, Jim.
You have time for... Okay, thank you. That same vehicle has a transmission thermostat, and there's YouTube videos online. You can buy a bypass for that, and it lets the transmission and the converter run 20 to 40 degrees cooler, which is really great for the torque converter
yep.
to extend its life. Any thoughts about... I don't know why Chevy did that.
Well, the engineering is valid. They're saying the thermostat will let that transmission run at an optimal temperature. It'll warm up faster. It won't be running too cold in the winter.
Yeah.
Great idea, but you're right. Those transmissions also had some problems. And I think when you take it to a transmission shop, the guys that really improve and overhaul them,
yeah.
I do believe they eliminate it.
Uh-huh.
Yes, I think that is happening in the field of transmission repair.
All right, Jim, I'm going to have to let you go there. We only have about 45 seconds. Email from Matt in New Paltz. I have a 67 Pontiac GTO.
Ooh.
After running for a while, when I turn off the car, it won't restart. If I let it sit for an hour, typically restarts. If I try and jump it without letting it sit for an hour, it won't start. I think this issue is a heat soak. If this is the case, how might I resolve it?
Yeah, great question and great car, Ray.
Yeah, what, buddy.
67 GTO,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
So that was a problem with those early cars, and by golly, I've experienced that with two of them.
Yeah.
And the starters will, when they get tired, they will heat soak, and the car will either not crank or crank like it's cranking over a cargo ship.
Yeah.
Like the battery's dead.
Right.
You can't boost it enough. Cools off, the car starts like a champ. Basically, without talking to this emailer, it's probably a starter.
Oh.
But you always want to be careful of your connections from the starter to the battery to the frame.
So you don't think
car.
It's a heat soak issue?
Well, it is, but I think it's because the starter is getting tired out and it doesn't like the heat.
Mm,
so
okay.
You can get a blanket, too, that protects them.
All right, fair enough. Last email from M. Just to let you know, no problem. I have a 66 VW, no problems. AC, power windows, emission controls, electronics, power steering, sensors are all good. All-wheel drive controls feels great.
That is a hilarious comment.
Talk about braggadocio.
I love it.
All right. Hey, Gordon Fricke, thanks again, man. We'll see you next month.
Yeah, absolutely.
Support comes from Temple Sinai, Saratoga Springs, an open congregation welcoming the Jewish community and visitors for Shabbat and holiday services, providing religious school, cultural programs, and more. SaratogaSinai.org. WAMC on the road, WAMC's new programming initiative bringing public radio in person throughout the WAMC listening area and face-to-face with listeners in their own communities. WAMC.org for more information. And Capital Roots, celebrating 50 years of making local food and green spaces accessible to all through mobile markets, community gardens, and innovative programs, CapitalRoots.org. Thanks again to Gordon Fricke for being here today. Thanks for calling and for emailing. I am sorry if we didn't get to your question. Gordon's on once a month. We'll do it again next month. Thanks to Riley Phillips, our engineer, Ed Rosen screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, computer expert Tony Yang will be back to tackle your tech issues. We'll see you too.